makes people kill? What specific element within a human being's psychological makeup pushes an individual across the threshold into the murderous zone of no return? Whilst the act of murder is horrific in itself, is there an extra element of grotesque when the murdered are bequeathed by a member of their own family? Are murderers born evil? Or is inflicting death upon others part of the psyche that is influenced by their upbringing and experiences? This is The Monstrous Crimes of Edmund Kemper. Edmund Emile Kemper III was born on December 18, 1948. The middle child of three, an only son, born to Edmund Kemper Jr. and Clarnell Kemper. Kemper was born in Burbank, California, and by most accounts lived a very disturbed childhood. Weighing over 13 pounds at birth, Kemper was always above average in size in both height and weight. He was subjected to violent and degrading abuse from his mother throughout his life, and psychologically the abuse that he suffered led him to have difficulty interacting with females and forming relationships in early adulthood. At age 8, Ed was forced to sleep in the cellar for around 8 months. This was as punishment, as Ed's mother didn't trust him to wander the house unchecked. Clarnell had begun drinking alcohol daily, as well as being diagnosed with borderline personality disorder around this time, thus becoming incredibly paranoid. She often referred to Ed in conversation with others as a real weirdo, and was obsessed with the thought that Ed was going to sexually molest his sisters during the night. While Ed behaved strangely at times, there was no grounds for his mother thinking these things, however. Ed's father left when he was 9 years old, having become sick and tired of Clarnell. He would later say that living with her was the worst experience of his life, and that includes the time that he served on the front during the Second World War. With his father having left, the reality of what he was left with hit home with Ed, and he was crushed. Ed's mother constantly told him that he reminded her of his father and how much she hated his father. Ed became riddled with anxiety and depression, not knowing when he would be lashed out upon next. He became a nervous wreck, but the nervousness and tension led to him behaving even stranger. While being locked in the cellar each night, and with only a single light bulb for light, Ed states his hatred towards women developed and began to grow. He said he would stare into the flames of the furnace for hours, and it was while staring into the flames that he saw the devil's face for the first time. Ed needed revenge. He was sick of being walked over by his hateful and vicious mother. So Ed took his revenge on the family by killing the family cat. He dug a hole 4 foot deep in the garden and threw the cat inside. It clawed and scrambled, trying to get out, but Ed struck it over the head with a shovel. It fell to the bottom of the hole, dazed and shocked, and Ed quickly dug the dirt back into the hole, burying the cat alive. Once it was dead, he dug it back up, and with a knife from his mother's kitchen, Ed chopped the cat's head off, placing the head on a spike overlooking his bed. Ed was 9 years old. Ed's favorite game to play as a child was one he made up called Gas Chamber. He would have his sister flick an imaginary switch, filling the room with gas. Ed would then act out an agonizing death from being gassed, writhing and lashing around the floor as if being starved of oxygen. Ed also had a dark fantasy life and would often conduct dark, made-up rituals using his sister's dolls. He would remove their heads and hands and commit sexual acts with the dolls, and also cast magic spells on his sisters and neighbors. At age 12, Ed started to steal his father's old bayonet knife and would go to his English teacher's house and watch her through the window, fantasizing about her. Sometimes he would spend hours in amongst the bushes just watching. He would hold the knife to his own throat while he masturbated and threatened to cut his own windpipe in rage, or utter to himself the grotesque things he would like to do to his teacher with that knife. Once, when asked by his sister if he wanted to kiss his teacher, Ed replied matter-of-factly, "If I kissed her, I would have to kill her first." At age 15, Ed ran away from home in Helena, Montana, and made his way to Van Nuys, California to stay with his father. Ed was unaware, though, until he got there that his father had remarried and was not pleased to see him. Ed stayed with his father for a short while, but Ed made his father's new wife uncomfortable, and she asked Ed Sr. to send him back home. Once he arrived home, in a fit of frustration, he killed the second family cat by slicing the top of its head off and pulling its brains out. Ed popped the cat's eyes out from the inside of its head with his fingers. He then chopped the rest of the cat up into small pieces and put the pieces in a shoebox in his closet to keep safe. In another instance of his parents passing the buck, Ed was sent to live with his paternal grandparents, where he was initially gifted a rifle and a knife and taught how to use them by his grandfather. These were then taken from him shortly after, however, after he was found to have killed a number of neighborhood pets and shot at several family cats in the area. Ed always went after cats. Psychologists would later say that this was because a feline bores the imagery of the female. Further, Ed's grandmother grew concerned after she witnessed him, without his knowledge, fondling her handgun in an erotic manner. Ed had found the gun whilst rummaging through his grandmother's underwear drawer. On August the 27th, 1964, Ed and his grandmother got into a heated argument while sat at the dinner table. Ed's grandfather was out grocery shopping and the argument quickly escalated. Ed stormed off, with his grandmother assuming he had left to cool off. Moments later, Ed returned to the kitchen with the rifle his grandfather had given him as a gift and shot his grandmother once in the back of the head and twice more in the back. Ed also grabbed a knife from the sink and stabbed his grandmother in the back three times. Knowing that she was dead, Ed waited at the front of the house for his grandfather to return home with the groceries. When he arrived a short time later, Ed walked out into the driveway and fatally shot his grandfather twice in the face. Ed stated years later that he was curious as to what it would feel like to kill his grandma, so he did it. And that after doing so, he simply had to kill his grandfather too, so he wouldn't have to see what he had done to his wife. Ed called his mother and told her everything that had happened. She advised him to contact the police and hand himself in, which he did. Ed was subsequently diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic and sent to Atascadero State Mental Hospital, sentenced for 5.5 years. While in hospital, Ed became the model inmate. The authorities tested his IQ and his score came out as 140 and cited as near genius. He befriended a psychologist on the medical staff and spent time there reading criminal psychology reports and assisting day-to-day with the medical team. He also had access to crime scene rape photographs, which at a time of his own developing sexuality resulted in some bizarre, unhealthy, and crazy effects on his own psyche. Through assisting the medical team and by having access to all the psychological paperwork, he worked out a pretty foolproof method of how to appear sane and cured, which led to his release after only 5 years in the mental hospital. Ed was convinced he could pull the wool over everyone's eyes. The psychologists involved in Ed's release strongly advised that Ed not be sent to live with his mother, but this advice was ignored, and Ed moved to Santa Cruz, where his mother was now working as a university administrator at California State University. By now, Ed was 21 years old, 6'9", and weighed over 300 pounds. Santa Cruz had always been a quiet little seaside town until about 1965, when California State University opened a campus in the town and put it on the map. By 1971, Santa Cruz was known as the murder capital of the world. Serial killer John Fraser had killed 5 all in one household there recently, and Herbert Mullen on his murderous rampage had claimed 13 victims there too. It was also sandwiched between the events to the south at Spahn Ranch 18 months earlier involving the Manson family, and events currently still unsolved and active to the north involving the Zodiac Killer. There was indeed a dangerous place, but it was also the height of the hippie movement and free love, so no one felt unsafe or in danger. Now that Ed was free, he had started working for the highway department. Both he and his mother were still locked in daily battles of rage and viciousness, but Ed had more freedom now and was coping better. He had originally purchased a motorbike when he was released from Atascadero, but after he was knocked off it, he filed a lawsuit against the driver who struck him and was awarded a $15,000 payout. This allowed him to purchase a yellow Ford Galaxy. And at this point, he said he couldn't believe all the young ladies that were hitchhiking and putting themselves in danger, all for the sake of a ride. Initially, Ed began picking female hitchhikers up and giving them rides with no ill will. But he was testing himself and testing the waters. Ed estimated he picked up around 150 females and took them where they wanted to go with no harm befalling upon them. But then he gave in to his ever-looming sexual urges. The final 6. On May 7th, 1972, Ed picked up two 18-year-old hitchhiking Fresno State University students, Mary Ann Pesky and Anita Mary Lochesa, agreeing to take them to Stanford University. After driving for an hour, he managed to reach a secluded wooded area near Alameda, which he was familiar with from his work at the highway department. Here, he intended to rape them, but having learned from serial rapists at Atascadero not to leave witnesses, he instead handcuffed Pesky and locked Lucchese in the trunk, then stabbed and strangled Pesky to death before killing Lucchese in a similar way. Ed put both of the women's bodies in the trunk of his Ford Galaxy and then returned to his apartment. He was stopped on the way by a police officer for having a broken taillight, but the officer did not detect the corpses in the car. Ed took the bodies into his apartment where he took photographs and had sexual intercourse with the naked corpses before dismembering them. He then put the body parts into plastic bags, which he later abandoned near Lomo Prieta Mountain. Before disposing of the two girls' severed heads in a ravine, Ed placed his penis into the mouths of the heads and forced intercourse with both of them. On the evening of September 14, 1972, Ed picked up a 15-year-old dance student, Aiko Ku, who was hitchhiking to a dance class after missing her bus. He again drove to a remote area, pulling a gun on Ku. He then proceeded to choke her unconscious, rape her, and kill her. He subsequently packed her body into the trunk of his car, had a few drinks at a nearby bar, then exited the bar and returned to his apartment. Now home, he had sexual intercourse with the corpse before dismembering and disposing of the remains in a similar manner to his previous victims. Ed also sliced strips of flesh from the victims' legs and baked the flesh in a homemade mac and cheese and devoured it. On January 7th, 1973, Ed was driving around the Cabrillo College campus when he picked up 18-year-old student Cynthia Ann Schall. He drove to a sequestered wooded area and fatally shot her with a .22 caliber pistol. He then placed her body in the trunk of his car and drove to his mother's house where he kept her body hidden in a closet in his room overnight. When his mother left for work the next morning, he had sexual intercourse with and removed the bullet from Charles' corpse before dismembering and decapitating it in his mother's bathtub. Ed kept Charles' severed head for several days, regularly engaging in necrophilia and forced facial intercourse, before burying it in his mother's garden facing upward towards her bedroom. He later remarked that his mother always wanted people to look up to her. On February 5, 1973, after a heated argument with his mother, Ed left his house in search of more victims. He encountered 23-year-old Rosalind Heather Thorpe and 20-year-old Alice Helen Liu on the UCSC campus. They both entered his car. He then fatally shot Thorpe and Liu with his .22 caliber pistol and wrapped their bodies in blankets. Ed again brought his victims back to his mother's house, this time beheading them in the car and carrying a headless corpse into his mother's house to have sexual intercourse with. He then dismembered the bodies, removed the bullets to prevent identification, and the next morning discarded their remains. This was not before removing more flesh that he put into a casserole for him and his mother to eat. On April 20th, 1973, after coming home from a party, 52-year-old Clonel Kemper woke Ed with a racket. While sitting in bed reading a book, she noticed Ed entering the room and said, "I suppose you're going to want to sit up all night and talk now." Ed replied, "No, good night." He then waited for her to fall asleep and returned to beat his mother's skull in with a claw hammer and then slit her throat with a knife multiple times. He subsequently decapitated her and forced intercourse with her severed head before using it as a dartboard. Ed then screamed a torrent of hate and abuse at the head for around an hour, then smashed her face into a pulp. He also cut out her tongue and larynx and put them in the garbage disposal to blend. Ed had sexual intercourse with his mother's corpse, hid it in a closet, and then went out to drink. Upon his return, he invited his mother's best friend, Sally Hallett, over to the house for dinner and a movie. When Hallett arrived, Ed strangled her to death, decapitated her, and spent the night with her headless body. He subsequently put her corpse in a closet, obscured any outward signs of a disturbance, and left a note to the police explaining what he had done. He initially fled to Colorado, but handed himself in via a phone call when he arrived. Edmund Kemper was given 7 life sentences on November the 8th, 1973, by a jury of his peers. He denied his right to appeal, and he specifically requested death by torture as his sentence. Kemper was the first prisoner to take part in the FBI Behavioral Sciences Unit project in the early 1970s, and his involvement led to the capture of Wayne Williams thereafter. Kemper is currently still serving his sentence at California Medical Facility in Vacaville, Solano County. He is said to be a courteous, intelligent, and model prisoner. What will follow is an actual interview with Ed Kemper from prison.
My mother was a sick, angry, hungry, and very sad woman. I hated her, but I wanted to love my mother. I watched the alcohol increase. I watched her social life drop off. I watched her get bizarre. She had terrible pain from her life, earlier life, her upbringing, a failed marriage with my father. I'm a constant reminder of that failure. I hate to distill it down into such into one word realities like that. There's a lot that leads into that happening, but that is what happened. They represented not what my mother was, but what she liked, what she coveted, what was important to her, and I was destroying it.
Why did you actually kill the girls?
My frustration, my inability to communicate socially, sexually. I wasn't impotent, but emotionally I was impotent. I was scared to death of failing in male-female relationships. I knew absolutely nothing about that whole area. Even if just sitting down and talking with the young lady. I need to be able to really communicate, and ironically enough, that's why I began picking people up. And I'm picking up young women. And I'm going a little bit farther each time. It's a daring kind of a thing. At first there wasn't a gun. I'm driving along. We go to a vulnerable place where there aren't people watching, where I could act out, and I say, no, I can't. And then a gun is in the car, hidden. And this craving, this awful, raging, eating feeling inside, I could feel it consuming my insides, this fantastic passion. It was overwhelming me. It was like drugs. It was like alcohol. A little isn't enough. At first it is, and as you adjust to that, psychologically and physically, you take more and more and more. It's the same process. So it finally came down to the thing of, do I dare bring this gun out? Already realizing if that gun comes out, something has to happen. It was going to happen. I didn't see it then, but it was going to happen. I was playing a dangerous game with a loaded gun that got us all.
Take care of yourself, everyone, and be kind to one another. And remember, stand firm as you enter the darkest night.